Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1980 Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, and legendary heroes that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the Central American Mythos section of Deities and Demigods, and this is a blend of Aztec and Maya mythology, and today we're going to be focusing on Maya mythology. Because there's just one entry today, but it's about two characters, Hunapu and Xpalanque, and secondly, those two characters are so important that I feel like we've got to give them an in-depth reading. It's actually not even the two characters so much as the text from which they come. So today, we're going to be talking about the Popol Vuh. Now, I've had reason to mention the Popol Vuh on this show before, because we quoted a section of it when we were talking about the bat deity Kamazots, who is one of the monsters that the hero twins Hunapu and Xpalanque encounter when they are in the underworld Xibalba. But I thought it would be worthwhile to talk about what the Popol Vuh is, its history, all that kind of thing. The Popol Vuh is a Quiche Maya document. So it's from a Maya community in the Guatemalan highlands. And it is a mythological text. It covers a lot of different subjects, but it's primarily about the adventures of the two hero twins, Hunapu and Xpalanque. They fight monsters, and then they embark on a particular quest into the underworld in order to avenge the murder of their father and their uncle. And they're part of a succession of twin heroes. So their father and his brother are also twins. They're called Hun Hunapu and Vukub Hunapu, which means one Hunapu and seven Hunapu. You'll sometimes see Hunapu referred to as Hun Ahau. I assume this is just because there are different ways of rendering his Maya name. Now, although this is a text that dates back to before the Spanish conquest, it was not written down until the 1550s. So it's in Quiche Maya, and it was first recorded phonetically in, as I said, in the 1550s, but it was then later translated into Spanish, which is basically how it kind of became well known. And it starts out with some sort of cosmological stuff, which is more important for the general reader than for our specific purpose of coming up with gods and monsters. Talks about how living beings were created, and then it begins with an adventure of the hero twins in which they fight seven macaw, Vukub Kakish, and I'm almost certainly going to mispronounce a lot of these Maya names, not my field. Here's what my translation, which is by Dennis Tedlock, has to say about this incident. This is sort of the first adventure in which we meet Hunapu and Xpalanque, and this is the kind of thing that they get up to. So Seven Macaw has basically decided to set himself up as the sun. You know, the world has just been created, there isn't proper sun yet, and he's out kind of disrupting the natural order together with his sons, Zipakna and Kabrakan. Kabrakan is also called just Earthquake in this translation. A lot of the time, Tedlock has translated the Maya names literally. So, for example, the sort of villains of the piece, Hunkame and Vukubkame, he's translated as One Death and Seven Death. Anyway, here is the beginning of the defeat and destruction of the Day of Seven Macaw by the two boys, the first named Hunapu and the second named Xpalanque. Being gods, the two of them saw evil in his attempt at self-magnification before the heart of the sky. So the boys talked. It's no good without life, without people here on the face of the earth. Well then, let's try a shot. We could shoot him while he's at his meal. We could make him ill, then put an end to his riches, his jade, his metal, his jewels, his gems, the source of his brilliance. Everyone might do as he does, but it should not come to be that a fiery splendor is merely a matter of metal. So be it, said the boys, each one with a blowgun on his shoulder, the two of them together. And so Seven Macaw and his sons are talking about how great they are, and the two boys saw evil in this, since our first mother and father could not yet be made. Therefore, deaths and disappearances were planned by the two boys. And so they shoot Seven Macaw with a blowgun. It was then that he was shot by Hunapu. The blowgun shot went right to his jaw, breaking his mouth. Then he went up over the tree and fell flat on the ground. Suddenly, Hunapu appeared, running. He set out to grab him, but actually, it was the arm of Hunapu that was seized by Seven Macaw. He yanked it straight back. He bent it back at the shoulder. Then Seven Macaw tore it right out of Hunapu. Even so, the boys did well. The first round was not their defeat by Seven Macaw. And I love Seven Macaw's reaction to this. And when Seven Macaw had taken the arm of Hunapu, he went home. Holding his jaw very carefully, he arrived. "What have you got there?" said Chimalmat, the wife of Seven Macaw. What is it but those two tricksters? They've shot me. They've dislocated my jaw. All my teeth are just loose. Now they ache. But once what I've got is over the fire, hanging there, dangling over the fire, then they can just come and get it. They are real tricksters, said Seven Macaw. Then he hung up the arm of Hunapu. And so they befriend some forest animals, and they go after Seven Macaw, and eventually they defeat him. So right away, we can see that these are not necessarily like the deities that we would want in a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. I mean, these guys feel like player characters. That is to say that they're proactive, adventurous types who go off and fight monsters. And indeed, later on in this, they're going to very much explore a dungeon. Now, I mean, you can have this be a piece of mythology in the world, but I feel like this would be a great place to introduce something like Glorantha hero questing. I'm sure I've talked about this before, but in the setting of Glorantha, which is the best fantasy setting, you can gain some aspect of a deity's powers by undertaking what's called a hero quest. That is a reenactment of one of that hero's great deeds, or deity's great deeds. And that can be as a sort of ritual, or it can be like genuinely you go into another world, or your soul is partly in another world, and you reenact those deeds. And they're always a little bit different, but the result is that you gain some of the power of that god because you behave in a godlike fashion. And this works in two ways. First, it's a way to incorporate a mythic scope into a game that can otherwise be quite grounded, because a lot of the time Glorantha, certainly the type of Glorantha play that I enjoy, is at this very kind of nutsy-boltsy fundamental level about how many sheep your clan has, so that it's hard to get that kind of epic scope in a way that maintains a feeling of player agency. Like, you can go to a huge battle with thousands of people in it, but you probably aren't going to be the one that turns the tide unless this campaign's been going on for a very long time. So hero questing lets you make the mythical personal. And it also gives an incentive to understand the setting's mythology. So for example, in the Glorianthan computer game, King of Dragon Pass, and I haven't played Six Ages Ride Like the Wind yet because it's only out for iOS, dang it, at least I think that's right. The first quest you're likely to undertake is the hero quest of Orlanth and Aroka, about how Orlanth ends a drought by slaying the creature that's been drinking up all the water. And you're going to do better at that quest if you know the myth of Orlanth and Aroka. Anyway, I think you could do something like this. Like, you could have a myth of the two brothers and their descent into Shibalba, and at the same time you could have Shibalba as a dungeon that your player characters would have to go and interact with. And in case I'm not making the pitch for a Shibalban dungeon appealing enough, let me introduce some of the characters who are going to be in there. Now, I've mentioned One Death and Seven Death to you, and you know what One Death and Seven Death love? They love playing ball. But they covet the fancy ball-playing equipment of Hun Hunapu and Vukub Hunapu, One Hunapu and Seven Hunapu, and so they lure them down to the underworld and they murder them up nice. But there's going to be a lot of ball playing in this game, so if you got a ball playing set of sub rules, I guess now would be the time. Anyway, here's a little bit more about the various Shibalbans. Now, I should say that none of these Shibalban characters are in the Deities and Demigods book, and on a related note, I should point out that there is no justice in this pig of an earth. So here's some of the Shibalban characters. And these are the lords over everything, each lord with a commission and a domain assigned by One and Seven Death. There are the lords named Scab Stripper and Blood Gatherer, and this is their commission, to draw blood from people. Next are the lordships of Demon of Pus and Demon of Jaundice, and this is their domain, to make people swell up, to make pus come out of their legs, to make their faces yellow, to cause jaundice, as it is called. Next are the lords Bone Scepter and Skull Scepter, the staff bearers of Shibalba. Their staffs are just bones. And this is their staff bearing, to reduce people to bones, right down to the bones and skulls, until they die from emaciation and edema. Next are the lords named Demon of Filth and Demon of Woe. This is their commission, just to give people a sudden fright whenever they have filth or grime in the doorway of the house, the patio of the house. Then they're struck, they're just punctured, till they crawl on the ground, then die. Next are the lords named Wing and Packstrap. This is their domain, that people should die in the road, just sudden death, as it is called. Blood comes to the mouth, then there is death from vomiting blood. So to each of them his burden, the load on his shoulders, just to strike people on the neck and chest. Then there is death in the road, and they just go causing suffering, whether one is coming or going. And then, so they send some messengers out of Shibalba, and these messengers of theirs are owls. There is Shooting Owl, like a point, just piercing. And there is One-Legged Owl, with just one leg. He has wings. And there is Macaw Owl, with a red back. He has wings. And there is also Skull Owl, with only a head alone. He has no legs, but he does have wings. There are four messengers, military keepers of the mat in rank. And so the Xibalbans are preparing to play ball when they invite one Hunapu and seven Hunapu down into Xibalba. And it says, this ball of theirs is just a spherical knife. White Dagger is the name of the ball of Xibalba. Their ball is just ground down to make it smooth. The ball of Xibalba is just surfaced with crushed bone to make it firm. And here's a description of the different parts of Xibalba, and we're going to see Hunapu and Xbalanque going through these later on, and in fact, we've seen one of them already in our description of Kamazots. But just to give you a sense of its wonderful dungeon potential, and Xibalba is packed with tests, heaps and piles of tests. This is the first one. The Dark House, with darkness alone inside. And the second is named Rattling House, heavy with cold inside, whistling with drafts, clattering with hail. A deep chill comes inside here. And the third is named Jaguar House, with jaguars alone inside, jostling one another, crowding together with gnashing teeth. They're scratching around. These jaguars are shut inside the house. Bat House is the name of the fourth test, with bats alone inside the house, squeaking, shrieking, darting through the house. The bats are shut inside. They can't get out. And the fifth is named Razor House, with blades alone inside. The blades are moving back and forth, ripping, slashing through the house. These are the first tests of Xibalba. So like different elementally themed dungeon rooms. Razor House? Jaguar House? Bat House? I mean, Cold House? You could put all your different Cryonax nonsense in there. So many wonderful opportunities. And this is just like the Underworld. You know, they summoned you down here. This is a prelude. You have to get through these things in order to play ball. Presumably against some kind of Space Jam-like team recruited from all the different monsters that you've defeated throughout your adventuring career, and they've now gone down to the Underworld, right? Anyway, I mentioned Blood Gatherer before, one of the Lords of Xibalba. He is actually Hunapu and Xbalanque's grandfather, Kuchumaquik. He has a daughter called Xquik, or Blood Moon, and she goes to see... So even after the Lords of Xibalba have cut off Hunapu's head, his head is growing in a tree, and Blood Moon goes to visit it, and she becomes pregnant, and so she has these children, Hunapu and Xbalanque. So they're kind of half Xibalban. She, by the way, gets a full Snow White story. Like, when the Lords of Xibalba find out that she's pregnant, they send her off to be sacrificed, but the messengers instead come up with a substitute heart and come back with it. It really is pretty on point. Anyway, I mean, the rest is pretty straightforward. Hunapu and Xbalanque go down into the Underworld to avenge the deaths of their father and his brother, and through a mixture of having a cool magical blowgun and animal friends and trickery and deception and, you know, pluck and grit and character and what have you, they go on down there and they defeat the Xibalbans in a way that is kind of understated. So if you remember from the Kamazots episode, Hunapu had his head cut off, but they made him an artificial one, so that was fine. But the original head of Hunapu got thrown into the ball court to be used as a ball. And through some trickery involving a rabbit, the boys get Hunapu's head back, and then... And so there's a bit here at the end that I gotta admit I don't really understand. Something happens with a squash, and then the Xibalbans just, like, give up and admit that they're defeated? I guess the idea being that, like... that they got tricked and it's not really the ball. I'm not really sure. I gotta tell you, if I were running this as a dungeon, I would make it a little bit more dramatic than showing them a squash. I mean, this is a pretty common theme of these kinds of mythological journeys, right? Where the hero is so great that there isn't really a whole lot of narrative tension, which is fine. I understand that this is not a novel. It's not meant to generate narrative tension. But anyway, my point is that Hunapu and Xbalanque are pretty cool. So one thing that you may have noticed is that I haven't mentioned Kukulkan or Kukumats, who is the feathered serpent deity of Maya mythology. I guess Kukulkan is his name in a different Mayan language. Remember, there are a number of them. He actually turns up in Book 4. I say Book 4. There actually aren't any divisions within the text, but most editions divide this into four stories. Anyway, at the end of Hunapu and Xbalanque's career, they become the sun and the moon, as I mentioned earlier. And then after that, humans are created and, you know, the gods teach them how to be good and so forth. There are other gods who intervene in their adventures. Hunrakan turns up. He's not in Deities and Demigods, but he's a kind of wind and sky god whose name may be the same as the Caribbean god whose name gives us the word hurricane. And there are a couple of other ones as well, including these various sort of animal spirits that I mentioned before. And another pair of twins who are Hunapu and Xbalanque's half-brothers, who are monkey artist and scribe deities. They're not in the Deities and Demigods book, which, for all that it says Central American mythology, it is more focused toward the mythology of sort of central and northern Mexico rather than the mythology of the Yucatan and of Guatemala and Honduras. Anyway, so that's Hunapu and Xpalanque. And the thing that I was saying about hero questing before, I guess my main point was that gods like these are among the most fun, right? Like Hercules is the most fun of classical deities. But how do you incorporate him into your game? Because he's the hero, he's the protagonist. That's what's so much fun about him, is that he's out there doing things, which is fine to read about, but in a game, that's not what you want, because you want your characters to be the ones who are out there doing things. So if you have, and I'm not saying necessarily the story of Hunapu and Xpalanque, but if you have some legend of the gods descending into the underworld, you need to keep it kind of at the level of the Popol Vuh. Like, there are a lot of cases where it's not clear exactly how Hunapu and Xpalanque got out of the jam they were in. It seems a little bit like the text serves almost as, and this is just me thinking out loud here, but it seems a little bit like the text may serve as like an indicator, like an outline for a spoken story where the speaker might know the details, or that those just aren't considered particularly important to this version of the story. So I'll give you an example from one of the other houses of Xibalba. So in a lot of cases, the trickery that they use is detailed. So for example, when they go into Jaguar House, you have a bunch of jaguars there, but they throw them some bones, and the jaguars are so excited about gnawing on the bones and fighting over the bones that they leave the boys alone. Okay, that all makes perfect sense. But then, here's Firehouse. This is all that it says. So next they entered the midst of the fire, a house of fire, with only fire alone inside. They weren't burned by it, just toasted, just simmered, so they were well when it dawned. Although it had been ordained that they be quickly killed in there, overcome, they weren't, and instead it was the Xibalbans who lost heart over this. So this is what it sounds like is like a little kid telling a story, right? Like they put him in a fire, but he wasn't burned. It was fine. You know, again, from a narrative standpoint, it feels like there's something you don't know, that there's some piece of context that you're missing. But from a gaming standpoint, this actually kind of makes a lot of sense, because all this myth does is give the players who have to go into Xibalba some kind of understanding of the threats that they face. Like, what's next? Oh, well, according to this, it's the House of the Fire, a house with fire alone inside. Okay, how do we deal with that? Well, it just says that, you know, Hunapu and Xpalanque were fine. Do you think they will be fine? No, those two are gods. We're going to have to figure something out here. So giving the players some kind of heads up about the type of threats that they face is good, and then you can let them use their own resourcefulness to deal with whatever it is that the threat might be. Whether that's, a simple, like, distraction of the monsters, or hiding inside your magic blowpipe, which seems to function as a sort of Leoman's tiny hut. I don't even know if it's magic. Maybe they can just get very small. I could have it the wrong way around. This level of mythological description seems like a pretty good one for a dungeon. And, like, honestly, there's a lot of great stuff in the Popol Vuh. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend that you do. I'm reading the Tedlock translation. I'm sure there are other ones out there. There are a couple of translations online. If you just Google Popol Vuh, you can find them. There's also an animated film, which I have not had the time to watch, but it looks to be inspired by Maya art. Twins seem to have fascinated a lot of cultures historically. I mean, that makes sense, right? Like, you thought you were going to have one baby, but instead you have two. How strange. And mortal twin heroes are something that turn up in different cultures, but I think this might actually be our first pair of divine twins in Deities and Yet Demigods. I could be wrong, though. The family relationship between Hunapu and Xpalanque doesn't really go anywhere. I mean, they're not what you would call characterized. You know, my knowledge of the planar cosmology is not as good as it could be, so it's very possible that Xibalba at least might have been used as the name of a plane, or it might have been actually put into the D&D planar system. But if it hasn't been, I feel like it ought to be. You know, Xibalba is a weird place. The underworld is associated with death. It doesn't seem to be strongly associated with any kind of moral framework, and I love the idea that they really love playing ball. I feel like there's a lot of classic sports movie tropes to be used in the story of Hunapu and Xpalanque. Like, indeed, they overcome a more powerful, unscrupulous ball team by using trickery, comedy, and deception, getting them all to go chasing off after this other ball while they get the real ball, that is to say, Hunapu's head, and then they grow a squash. Not sure about that part. But, like, definitely you can imagine a lot of sports comedy tropes, which is a weird thing to imagine in a place where we already had the Razor House. So anyway, I hope that you can understand why I wanted to focus in so much detail on the stories of Hunapu and Xpalanque, because they're so important. They're such an important part of one of the most important pieces of contemporary with the conquest Maya literature, and Shibalba and its inhabitants are so full of potential for gaming that I really wanted to stop and take a look at them, especially given that they're not in the Deities and Demigods book. In our next episode, we'll be back to our usual two deities per schedule, and we're going to take a look at Itzamna, the god of medicine, and here's an important one for you from Aztec mythology, Mictlantecuhtli, the god of death. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.